Hello and welcome to another episode of Twig and Soap Talk Games. I am, of course, Paul Soapbox Klotz, and I'm joined, as always, by my friend, Twig.
Twig from Get Off My Lawn Gaming.
Yeah. So we're back to talk about, you know, what's been going through our minds about gaming recently. Twig, what have you been playing recently?
I have been playing most recently, right before I got on to record this, just like I did last week, an arcade game. And every so often on Instagram, I'll put up something called what I call on today's Retro Spotlight. And I spotlighted this game not too long ago. It's a beat-em-up, which actually is my favorite beat-em-up of all time. It's Cadillacs and Dinosaurs. That is a game that was a graphic novel to begin with by Dark Horse Comics, or they published it. And memory serves, Marvel ended up buying the rights to them in the early 90s, and there for 2 years it had a Saturday morning cartoon. Back in 1993, I think it was. Wow. That game has not been ported to any console. You can only play it if you have the original cabinet or the original PCB, or you play it on MAME. What differentiates this game from the other beat-em-ups like Streets of Rage or Final Fight is the graphics are on par with Final Fight, but it introduces gunplay because the enemies will drop guns, similar to the Punisher, which is another great side-scrolling beat-em-up. But this one has a little bit more gore in it. You're fighting dinosaurs, obviously enough, along with the poachers. But the thing is, you don't kill the dinosaurs. When you shoot them or you knife them or whatever you're going to do to the dinosaurs, it turns them from orange, which is they're under the trance of the poachers, to green, and then they're fine, and you let them go. So basically, you're rescuing the dinosaurs. Cadillac comes in level 3, where you actually drive a Cadillac, and you get to mow down all the enemies, and that's kind of a fun game. But you need to check it out. It's Cadillacs and Dinosaurs, and in my opinion, it is the most fun beat-em-up there ever has been created.
Yeah, just remember, if you want to save the dinosaurs, you have to knife them and shoot them with cuddles.
Hey, that's exactly right. I mean, and it's made by Capcom, the same people that did Final Fight, so you know what you're getting into as far as gameplay mechanics and visuals. It's a very, very nice looking game for an early 90s game. And also, it was kind of ahead of its time when that was one of the few games that I recall where you could ever play as a female in the game, and matter of fact, she's the best character to play with. Name is Hannah D, I think it is. But she is the best character. She's the fastest and has the best reach, which is very forward thinking for the early 90s.
Well, yeah, that's because it was a couple years after that we got like Lara Croft, right? That really,
yes, exactly right.
That kind of blew the doors off on like having female protagonists and characters in games that weren't just. I mean, obviously, like, there was an element to her that was meant to market to young men, but she was still an interesting character, and her games were interesting, and she was empowered through them, and that kind of brought about a bit of a change where we saw more prominent female characters in video games. So, yeah.
Make no mistake, Capcom could have named her Hannah Double D's, and I'm pretty sure that was on purpose.
I was going to make that joke, but I was like, you know, it's probably a little stranger than fiction. It's probably the
truth. Exactly. But great game. Check it out.
All right. That's cool. I got to play a side-scroller that I've been waiting to play for a while lately. I played a bit of The Messenger, which was published by Devolver, and that is a... You know, it's kind of a retro throwback, but it's a more recent indie, well, not indie, you know, small publisher title.
Right.
Devolver being, like, definitely a step above the indie, but not, you know, not a full-blown AAA publisher. And The Messenger is, the gist of it is you're a ninja, like a ninja trainee and in this ninja clan, and all of a sudden this demon army shows up and tries to, like, take over the world, and you have to carry this special scroll to the top of the mountain where the sage is. And it's all very, it's intentionally like old school vague, tongue in cheek, like everything is a little bit like, like this is the premise, but it's a fun little side scroller. You know, it's platforming, and it's also got a little bit of a like roguelike element where you can get upgrades and stuff. And you know, so you can kind of change the way your character plays and stuff as you progress through the game. And it was pretty fun. I only played it for maybe a half an hour because I was recording footage for a YouTube video. I needed something to throw in the background while I ranted about Humble Bundle. And yeah, so it's fun, and it's something I'm going to play more of. And other than that, you know, I'm on the Hunt Showdown kick. That game is just so wonderful, and it is such a joy to play. I'm not going to keep gnawing everybody's ears off with it, but it's a wonderful game. You should check it out. If anything, even if you don't end up picking up the game because it might not be your thing, watch some streamers play it because it's a lot of fun. So
right.
We do have a topic this week, and it's one that you brought to the table, and I think it's kind of interesting. You wanted to talk about things in gaming that don't resonate with us. And, you know, these are, obviously we're speaking of individual tastes. And I think that's an interesting topic because a lot of times people talk about what they love. They don't talk about what they don't get. So go ahead, kick us off.
All right. Well, again, I want to underscore that these are subjective opinions. And I'm sure that everything that I bring up, you'll either you or listeners will point out that I'm in the minority. And I'm fine with that. I want to start out with the biggest one, and that is the Nintendo Wii. Video games prior to that, you sat down with a controller and hand-eye coordination is all you needed.
Mm-hmm.
On the surface, the Wii sounded cool, and then started the whole motion thing with the Kinect with, you know, on the Xbox, and then the PlayStation Move and all that. I just didn't enjoy it. Bowling was kind of cool. That's one of the titles that I do like on the Wii. Is the Wii Sports ones, that, you know, that was, I don't think it was a pack-in game, but it was one of those, it was a launch title. Bowling was kind of cool. Tennis is okay. I'm sure at that time that I was just wanted to remain being lazy. Maybe I'm in the minority, but it just didn't resonate with me. I mean, I don't want to sweat to play video games. I just don't. That's one of the things for me.
Well, you know, okay, so this isn't really a rebuttal, but I get where you're coming from, because I recall when the Wii came out, first of all, you know, gangbusters. It was impossible to find them for like the first year and a half. And I think the novelty at the time was like, well, for one, if you had kids that were playing on it, everything that you're saying, when you put that in the hands of your children and they get to work out all that energy, that's a big win-win for a lot of parents, you know?
I get it.
They get to have a good time. They get to be physically active. And, you know, it gets them to work their energy out. But it was so innovative, right? Like, so you mentioned Microsoft and Sony's, like, attempts to emulate what was successful about the Wii. And let's be frank, they were never, ever as good as the Wii. Like, the Wii was the first, and they killed it. And you mentioned stuff like Wii bowling. I've heard of, like, schools having Wii bowling, like, setting up a couple stations with Wiis where the kids could play Wii bowling, because it was sensitive enough to be reasonably accurate to the experience without having to have all the equipment or bring them to a bowling alley and all that entails.
Right.
And it is exactly what you're saying. They would have to sweat. They would have to play the game a bit. And I recall from Wii Sports, the boxing game was, like, really brutal. Like,
I tried it once.
Yeah, you definitely would work up a sweat playing the boxing game and a few of the other games. So I kind of hear what you're saying. For me, never really an issue, but I did eventually get a Wii, because I worked in consumer electronics retail at the time, and my store got a copy of the Wii, which we were a now defunct electronics store that used to, you know, be the bee's knees. It was not when I worked for them near the end of their heyday. It was Radio Shack. The company doesn't exist anymore. I don't have to beat around the bush. It was Radio Shack. We got a Wii in to sell, and, like, I was like, I'm going to buy this. I bought it. I brought it home. We played it. Like, I had a lot of roommates at the time. We played it, like, once or twice, and my roommate's girlfriend and her friends played it a few times, and then it just kind of sat there. And the magic had worn off. You know, like, after a while, the novelty and the magic wore off for me. And it was like, yeah, this just doesn't, this doesn't do what my PC can do. It doesn't do what a PlayStation can do. I'm not getting the same kind of robust experiences off of this. I'm getting, you know, you have the novelty experiences that were unique, and that was about it. And once that fades, it, I don't know.
And try to play any of their non-movement games with that Wiimote turned sideways. Yes, they had the Pro Controller. I get that, but a lot of people didn't have that, and if they wanted to play Super Mario Wii, the platformer, not the galaxies, then, you know, they turn that Wii remote sideways, and that thing is just extremely awkward to try to play games with. It's horrible.
Oh yeah, I agree completely. And calibrating the Wiimotes wasn't always the easiest thing either. So yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. Basically, what I'm saying is, yeah, it wasn't a big turnoff for me, but the novelty faded, and I realized that I had wasted my money in buying that console that I never played.
Well, at least it was cheap.
Well, I paid retail for it a few years into its cycle. I ended up selling it, getting a chunk of that back. I think I got like half of it back, which is fine. It went to a family with some kids that were definitely going to use it. So, you know, that's one of those things, like, if I'm gonna unload something that just didn't work out for me, if it goes someplace that it's gonna get good use, I'm fine with taking a bit of a hit. And
really, you're talking about that like it was a dog. As long as it's going to a good home.
Yeah, you know, like I don't want it to go to some neckbeard like myself's collection where it sits on a shelf and nobody ever plays it. I mean, if I
bet that's where it is now.
Maybe, I don't know. It's probably just collecting dust. But I'm sure you have more on your list, but I'll jump in with something.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's some genres of games. Visual novels is really big with some people, and you know, it, for anybody who's like, "What the hell is a visual novel?" You know, they're basically a iteration of your point-and-click adventure-type games. They're usually based in, like, anime or other Japanese properties, but there's been a resurgence in recent years of, like, more adventure games that are... The lines have blurred a bit, and there's a big...
For clarification, are you talking about games with nothing but quick-time events, like Heavy Rain?
No. I'm talking about story-driven... You know, choose your own adventures, like adventure games. You know, there were classic adventure games, and then at some point, Japan kind of got a hold of the adventure game concept, and they kind of put their anime manga spin on it, and now they're called visual novels. And so you have some classic Western adventure games, and then you have some Japanese visual novels, and then you have some crossover, and it just, I've looked into it a few times, and it's just really not my bag. Basically playing an RPG where there's no combat or gameplay, and it's all right, just the dialogue, is not a win for me. But I do respect that people enjoy it, and people who enjoy that genre tend to, like, get more games in it, and that's cool. There was one game, though, that is a standout, and that is Doki Doki Literature Club. And that is because it is it's a bit of a spin on the genre where it's a kind of surprising, well, quite frankly, it's a mind screw. It takes a turn after you've been playing for a while, and it turns into kind of a horror game. And it doesn't seem like it at first. It seems like just a, you know, cutesy anime characters are like, you know, they're normal drama. And then all of a sudden, things just get really dark and weird. And I may have just ruined that for some people, but honestly, if it wasn't on your radar already, it probably never was going to be. But that's a crazy beast. And that game got a ton of praise because it completely subverted expectations. Like, people did not expect. And once it once a few people played it and saw it take that turn, they started whispering about it on the internet, and then it became this thing that people had to see happen. And so I know some streamers who have like played it and stuff, and content creators who played it on their YouTube channels and stuff. And getting to that point where everything gets weird is just so awesome. And so that's a standout. I don't necessarily want to play it, but I completely respect that somebody was like, this is genre, this is the rut that it's in, we're going to break out of that, and we're going to completely surprise everybody. And so that's a thing.
Well, as much as I love narratives that we've already discussed in stories, I'm sorry, narrative in the games, but I also want gameplay. Those, I know vaguely about what you're referring to, so I don't have anything to rebut other than I have no experience with it, and as much as I dislike and can't stand anime, I know that I'm not going to want to play a game with watching those big brat's doll eyes, big mouth, cartoony crap. That's not my thing. Not at all. So we could just scratch that completely off of my bucket list as to never having experience with and dying happy.
Aw, boo-hoo, Twig doesn't want to watch the animated stuff in a genre full of animated stuff.
No, I cannot stand anime. I hate it.
That's fair. I think
give me Elmer Fudd and I'll be happy.
I think it's a generational thing, honestly. Growing up in the 80s and 90s, There were a handful of really prominent... We're getting a little off topic here, but I'm going to dive into it because it's a fun topic. There were some early anime that got adapted, you know, that basically got dubs for the West, and they got brought over in particular in the 90s. And, you know, like, yeah, I'm sure anybody who knows anything at all about anime has heard of stuff like Akira and Vampire Hunter D and stuff like that. And those came over and they made a splash because basically what ended up happening is some of the best of what was on offer in Japan, you know, they grabbed that and they're like, all right, let's localize it for the West and show it to the Western audiences. So there were only a handful of things available, at least readily available. But what was available was really good, like story-wise, and very stylized and just kind of set a tone. And that resonated with a lot of us who were growing up then. I remember sitting and watching Dragon Ball Z and my father being on his computer.
Oh my God.
Looking over at it and being like, this is so stupid. Why do you watch this?
If you bring up fucking Yu-Gi-Oh, I'm just going to have to tap out.
Oh no, I am not a Yu-Gi-Oh person. Ever.
Okay.
No. That was Yu-Gi-Oh came a little bit after my time. I was a little too old to get hit with that bat. But yeah, no, like it. There were, and it was tonally very different in the early days. Like, the stuff that came over during the 90s was dark and violent and, you know, sometimes dealt with really mature themes. Like, really out there stuff. And nowadays, when people talk about anime, the mainstream anime of today are not like that at all. Like, most stuff is not. There's the occasional outlier thing that, like, people talk about that is really dark or whatever, but for the most part, it's just completely changed. And it's been Disney-fied in a way, but in the distinctly Japanese way. But yeah, the old stuff, you know, it was this new thing that was really hard to find. There was that whole, like, digging through the back bins aspect of it for us in the 90s, of like, it's hard to find these things. There's only a handful of them available in the West that you can actually watch and understand what's going on. They're really stylized. They're some of the best stuff that came out of Japan. It's brought over. It created this perfect soup for my generation that if it caught your interest, it became something that really resonated with you. But...
And what's funny about that is that, not really debatable, that the 90s had some of the best cartoons, like on Nickelodeon, mm-hmm. and things like that, that were ever produced.
Well, we watched those too. Like, it wasn't an either-or thing for us. It was just, we would watch something amazing like the X-Men cartoon, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the best Saturday morning cartoons of all time, with some of the best writing for a Saturday morning cartoon of all time. But then we would go check out something like Akira, which is this really dark, look, or Ghost in the Shell, these really dark looks at humanity. Like, they're very deep stuff, and if they were had been done, if, like, the film adaptation for Ghost in the Shell with Scarlett Johansson that came out a few years ago that had all the drama surrounding it, if that had come out 20 years earlier with somebody different, you probably would have watched it, and you probably would have been like, that was pretty cool. But it took forever to get done, and, you know, I understand why the anime style is a turnoff, because it is a unique world. And that bleeds into the video games. Like, to bring it back around to video games, that bleeds into stuff like JRPGs.
There are some JRPGs that I like, but for the most part, they're not on my bucket list.
Well, JRPGs are firmly rooted in that anime / manga tradition. You know, a lot of the tropes that appear in anime and manga appear in Japanese RPGs. And, you know, the stuff like the Marios, they're not as big of a deal because, you know, they're not so drastically different from what we're used to here in the West that they stand out as being distinctly Japanese. They're just kind of accessible. But the JRPGs are like, they're often playing on very distinctly Japanese tropes and stuff, so.
Yeah, well, people are going to think that I'm anti-Japanese, which I'm not. I just don't like that art style.
That makes sense. Hey, I get it. You're an old racist. That's fine.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah. So, let's see. What else do you have that doesn't resonate with you? That one doesn't count because it was mine.
Right. VR. Just anything VR. I mean, going all the way back to the virtual, maybe it's because of the Virtual Boy that I'm anti-VR. I owned one of those, and at the time when it came out, that was the closest thing we could get to virtual reality. So, in hindsight, the thought was cool, and Nintendo may have been ahead of its time a little bit with their thinking, but the execution was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever played anything on Virtual Boy?
I haven't played on it, but I've seen some videos that dug into it and showed some of the gameplay and stuff. Yeah, it was absolutely ahead of its time. It was a novelty. Let's be real.
Right. But even going in to current, I just can't see myself wanting to drop the extra dollars it takes to either equip the PS4 or get an Oculus. I think that would be, like the Wii, a novelty that would wear off. And I think I've learned my lesson from the Wii, that I don't want to get anything that's so novel in concept. I know VR has been around for a few years. That's not what I'm trying to say. But for me, it's a new concept. And I think it would be something that I would try and just put back down and go right back to what I've been doing my entire life. Hmm. It's one of those things where if it's not broke, don't fix it. You know what I mean? So VR, for me, is just, I just can't wrap my head around it.
So my roommate has a Vive, and his sister bought it for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cool. I'll be honest with you. Actually, my other friend has a Vive as well. And there was a time where they were like both gelling on it, and they were getting some of the same games and stuff. And the new VR stuff is very promising. But again, it's a novelty. Is my issue. Half-Life Alyx might be the first title for VR that is like, this is what a big, prominent AAA publisher can do with a budget, just to work on something and do a really robust presentation for the platform. Because a lot of the other stuff is just, they're kind of gimmicky. Yeah, we're playing on the VR aspect of things, but, and it, for me, the issue is the barrier of entry. Like, a Vive or an Oculus Rift or any of these other VR devices are generally pretty expensive.
Yes.
They require complicated setup that is not maybe super obvious to a lot of people. And more so than all of that, they require space. You have to have a setup for it. Like, you have to be able to carve out an area. You know, you can't put a VR system in your home entertainment system as readily as you can just about anything else, you know?
No, but if you have a Wii, you're already set up for that.
Yeah, sort of, I guess. I was going to make that comment. I was like, well, unless you have a Wii. So, you've got to set up the cameras. You know, they got to be mounted around the room, whether you mount them on a wall or put them on stands or something. And you have to clear all that space because once you have the headset on, you become a ticking time bomb of bumping into people and or things if everybody's not aware of what's going on.
Right.
There have been some standouts, though. Like, Half-Life Alyx is recent. Really well received. Like, that hit the market, and people were like, this is what VR could be. You have Beat Saber, which is, you know, it's a rhythm game where you're slashing lightsabers along to tunes. It's kind of like Guitar Hero combined with, you know, an exercise game, which you and I would hate. But
absolutely.
Some people really love it and really enjoy it, and they feel like they can get a really crazy workout out of it and have a lot of fun while doing it, and I think that's cool.
We'll just get a Dance Dance Revolution cabinet.
Yeah, that's no small thing. Yeah, barrier to entry for VR. Like, you got to set up these cameras about on the walls. Oh, let's just clear, you know, a 20 by 20 foot space for a DDR cabinet. And also, how the hell would you get a DDR cabinet into the average home? You'd have to knock out a wall and be like, yeah, we're remodeling.
It's probably a little bit wider than 36 inches.
VR, I agree with you on VR, because, like, right now, the experiences that are available, they're neat. They're cool. If somebody's listening to this and you own a VR device and you really enjoy using it, I'm not taking anything away from you. I think that's fantastic. But for me, there's not enough there. I've played my roommate's Vive. It's neat. I don't want to play it. One, I don't want to wear that headset for like 3 hours. Like, that is just not appealing to me. I don't need all of that sweaty nonsense. It's not there.
Don't need all that COVID getting rubbed into your forehead.
But that said, I see the potential. You know, when 20 years ago, when I was sitting with my dad and we were playing games like EverQuest and Ultima Online, we'd watch like tech TV or something, and they would do a thing on like VR and what was available at the time and what could happen with it. And we really thought within a few years we were going to see full-scale VR. You know, it was going to be the thing. And Hollywood thought that too. I don't know if you remember, but in like the 90s, everybody thought VR was going to be right around the corner. Nobody knew it was going to take 20, 25 years to get there.
Right. Well, just like 3D TV, 3D televisions. That was around for what? Maybe 5 years? And it's gone away again?
Yeah, the 3D thing, not to get out of video games again, but the 3D thing, like, Hollywood was like, this is it. This is everything. And everybody else was like, tight, but like after a while, we were like, nah, not everything.
Well, I did download a demo for one on the PS3 for one 3D. It's a driving game. I don't remember what it was called, but I found it very fun.
Yeah.
Now, that's something that I could have invested in had the technology kept upgrading and going about. I love the 3D gaming. I didn't like it on television, but I love the gaming. But it's just like TV, it went away too.
Well, you know, the problem with the 3D stuff on the television was if you're trying to play video games, you had the delay, right? Like, once you turn on the 3D feature, and so, like, I played Black Ops on a Samsung smart TV that had 3D. And I played it in 3D, and the problem was it had a visual lag. So you can't play an online shooter, for example, with that feature. I mean, you can. It's possible. But it wasn't good, because I would be a couple frames behind what I thought I was doing. You know, somebody that I'm shooting at would actually already be a couple feet to the side or something like that. It wasn't good. And so it didn't really work for that. And then it became a question of, like, well, what games could I play? Like, am I going to play like a turn-based JRPG this way? Like, then I guess I don't really care then. You know, I wanted to play the really exciting in-your-face stuff with the 3D function, and that just ultimately didn't matter. It was flash in the pan. I don't think VR is flash in the pan like the 3D TVs were. But I do think that it's not there yet. And I do think that the venture capitalist investment into the idea is starting to dry up. At least that's my impression. I'm not an expert on this, but I know like VC was really big on, oh, you got a VR device? It's going to be, okay, yeah, let's give you a pile of money. Let's help you get that prototyped and get that to market. And so there was the race of like 5 years ago where we were watching the Oculus Rift and the Vive. I forget what Valve was working on at the time. I forget the name of theirs. And like everybody's got a different way of doing this, and we're going to have this really revolutionary technology very soon. And we got the technology.
Well, when I played the driving game, it was a dune buggy type game, so it probably had lag in it too, but it wasn't nearly as noticeable as I'm sure it would have been in first person shooters.
Right, exactly. And that was my whole argument with the 3D thing, is basically like the games that I really wanted to have it in, it was going to cause problems, and the other games I didn't care if I had it. So that was my issue. But yeah, VR, the tech is there finally, but the games aren't quite there yet, though we're starting to see a change in that. I would like to see maybe in 5 years what VR looks like. Maybe if the cost of the units comes down, if the games become more robust and are a deeper, more integrated experience that are akin to what we expect out of the narrative-based video games that we love today. You know, if we get something like, could you imagine playing something like Last of Us for the first time on a VR headset? That would be insane. If it was
done
well.
Or any of the Resident Evils, that would be pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, so that stuff would all be pretty interesting. So I'm trying to think of like something else that just doesn't really work for me.
Well, I mean, I've got one more if you want to continue thinking.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mine is a little more broad, and I know this got to be generational. The shift to digital media from physical copies. I know why. It makes sense. I'm old school, and I like seeing them on my shelf, and that will never change.
I understand where you're coming from. I'm somebody who likes to collect. I've fallen into collecting lots of different things over the years. But I'm also someone who has run up against the fact that my collection of whatever thing it might be got to a point where it became detrimental. You know, like, I used to collect Magic the Gathering cards. I eventually turned that into a business where I sold all of the stuff that I collected, and that was good. But when you have 5 or 6 10,000 count boxes in the corner filled with cards, and it's mostly chafe, it's mostly literally like, you know, stuff you could use as mulch. It becomes a problem. And I think it's the same thing with video games. I see people, like particularly the retro gamers on YouTube, who have these amazing setups. They're beautiful. They have all their retro games. You know, the guys who are chasing, I'm going to collect everything on the NES. I'm going to collect everything on the Genesis, whatever it happens to be. And they're just, you look at some of these people and they have to buy a new house and like convert the entire basement to become their new, you know, their warehouse basically. And it becomes this thing of like, that's just such a commitment and it's so much stuff. And it's really cool. And I'm sure the thrill of the chase is everything, but it's like such a, like when you have to move house, what's the deal with all of that, you know? And then you also deal with stuff like if something happens to your home, if like you have a flooding issue or some kind of natural disaster comes through. Like, I couldn't imagine the horror of doing something like being on the quest to collect like a full NES collection, getting there, and then having something catastrophic happen. And not only do you lose everything else that's really important, like your home and all your keepsakes and everything that goes along with that, but you lose that thing that's been your quest for X amount of years that was like your holy grail, and then like it just goes up in smoke, maybe something else.
Well, I'm sure you saw the episode of MGR when he found the potential flooding issue in his basement where all his games were. They ended up having to pay somebody to come out there and fix that. He caught it in time, but it could have easily.
I was actually
it could have easily.
I was actually just thinking about that. You know, Metal Jesus Rocks had this situation, I think it was like a year or so ago, where he had a little bit of flooding. He noticed some early flooding in the basement. And basically, without getting into it too much, it was something that had never been an issue before that became an issue because of something that was done outside of the house. And he was looking at thousands of dollars to deal with it. And he was worried about how it could affect his collection because he has a lot of console, like retro console stuff, but he also has like big box PC games, which are, they are so vulnerable. You know, like moisture can destroy a big box PC collection. You can get away with moisture being around a lot of, you know, depending on what era of physical video games you're collecting for consoles. Definitely if you're like a newer collector, if you're collecting like PlayStation 2, 3, PlayStation 1, that kind of stuff forward, because they all come in jewel cases or, you know, the more modern plastic cases, and you can wipe them off and move on in most cases if you catch it early. But like big box PC games, all it takes is a day or two exposed to moisture and you've got irrevocably damaged stuff, which really sucks. So yeah, no, that is like the horror story, right?
Exactly. But with the shift towards digital media, you also have two more pressing issues that could happen with that. I know they're going to all digital. It's just a matter of time. I know that. It's not going to stop. But it also causes hour-long tutorials in games because there are no longer manuals. Well, I enjoyed reading the manuals.
There's no manuals for physical games anyways.
I know, but there used to be. And there didn't used to have hour-long tutorials in the games after you already spent 2 hours downloading it and then another hour getting the update for it on the day one because they released a half-finished game.
Well, you already ranted about day one. See, dude.
I did, but I just wanted to add that to my argument.
Okay. Okay.
And then what about space? What about space? I mean, you get a console that has, what, a terabyte now? And the games, especially like GTA 5, what is that, 90 gigs off the top right there? So that's almost a tenth of your entire space for one game.
Well, yeah, that's like the new Call of Duty, right? The Modern Warfare, and it has the new Battle Royale mode. I thought about trying out the new Battle Royale mode. I was like, I used to like the Call of Duty series. I would give it a try because it's free to play. 200 gigs. That game wants just shy of 200 gigs to install because you have to install the base game and then you have to install all of the Battle Royale stuff as well. I'm like, no. No.
That's 20% of a terabyte storage. That's ridiculous for one title. And then when you go to all digital, you're going to have to come to a point where you're either going to have 15 external hard drives or you're going to have to continuously take games off to put new games on. They stay in your library. I get that. You can reinstall them at any time. But at some point, that becomes a pain in the ass. You know what I mean?
Well, the issue with that, for example, with Nintendo, Philip Keating, who I used to be on Breaking the Panel with, you know, he's a big Nintendo fan. And we would, you know, coalesce on this issue a lot because we're constantly, he's the same way as you and I. He likes to collect things. He loves to own the physical versions of things. But we look at like the Nintendo products where it's like the eShop is amazing in its own way. But the problem becomes eventually when the next console comes out, they sunset the old shops eventually. So like they recently sunsetted the Wii Shop, right? And like you can, I think you can still download some stuff, but for the most part, you're kind of stuck. And correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure somebody will be like, they didn't. You're so stupid. I sold my Wii, so I don't know what it's like. But I know there was a big issue where people were like, all these games that I love, I have to either download them or I just don't have access to them anymore. And eventually that'll happen with the Switch, right? Eventually the Switch will be like, Nintendo's going to be like, we want to shut off these servers, so download whatever you want to keep, and that's it. And we're moving on to, the Switch 30 XL or whatever it's going to be by then. The new 3D Switch XL. Sorry. It's a this meme.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess they're at some point going to be running into limits on even SD cards you can put in there. I mean, you can throw a 256 gigabyte SD card in your Switch and you can get some use out of it. But mm-hmm. I mean, to your point, it will fill up as well.
Yeah. And so, you know, I'm always back and forth on this, right? I own, let me look at my collection here. I own like 15 or so physical Switch games. Some of them I didn't need to buy. So, but some of them I bought because they were cheaper on physical than they would have been if I bought them digitally, and I'm fine with that. Some of them I bought because I want the resellability. We talked about Pokemon back in the first episode. The Pokemon games have always retained their value. If you have a physical copy of a Pokemon game, you can get near MSRP for that on the secondary market. Like, used copies get marked down like $5. And they sell. You know, especially the older, hard-to-find ones.
Yes, I have a Leaf Green for Game Boy Advance that has Mewtwo. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much that would go for now. It's not leaving my house, but yeah. But I'm just curious. That's got to be up there by now.
And, you know, most physical video games cannot retain that value, right? Like, we can just acknowledge that. But in this case, they do. You know, the Pokemon games, some of the other Nintendo first-party stuff can retain its value. It doesn't depreciate.
Nintendo certainly thinks they do because they never marked those first-party titles down. Well, ever.
It's annoying to us as a consumer, but it works for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
The market perception for first-title Nintendo titles is that they're... I mean, I think here in the United States, the best deal we can get is you can get pretty much any game immediately out the gate from Walmart for $10 off, if I recall correctly. So most of them are like $50. Which is cool, because it's like, when you're talking about 50 versus 60, that's a significant savings. That's good. I'm mm-hmm. good with that. That's how I've bought a few of my games. You know, I'm like, Walmart? Yeah, okay. If you're going to knock $10 off the top for me. And then GameStop, like, if the game's not selling, GameStop's like, please give us something. Give us something.
Yeah, your cell phone. Yeah, your cell phone.
But the digital versus physical thing is an interesting beast. As a PC gamer, I long ago had to accept that physical media was the way of the buffalo. And the last PC game I bought a physical copy of was Overwatch in 2016.
Wow.
And I specifically bought it a physical copy because I wanted the box for my collection. For what you're talking mm-hmm. about, Overwatch has been one of my greatest disappointments because I absolutely love what Blizzard did with the character design and the world design for that game, the lore, the all of the story elements that they've put together, the visual design. Amazing. It's some of the coolest crap I've ever seen in my life. So cool. And I was like, I want to have that game on my shelf. The actual gameplay for me gets kind of repetitive after a while, and I just really not thrilled by it. So that's been a big disappointment for me. But I wanted to have it on my shelf. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find PC games with physical copies for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a thing anymore. And so, yeah, and then came the advent of Steam, when Steam really kicked off about 10 years ago. And all of a sudden, they became the premier digital storefront for video games on PC. And they started doing these insane sales all the time, where you could get games for pennies on the dollar. And I really mean, like, when they used to do the Lightning Deal thing back in, like, 2012, 2013, I think they stopped it in 2014. You know, they would have their summer sale or their holiday sale or whatever, and then they would do these lightning deals. Like, every 12 hours, something would go 80% off. And you'd be paying, like, $2 for a game that was $60 at one point or something. And it was crazy. And you're like, yeah, no, I don't need physical media if I'm going to be paying pennies, literally pennies. And then, of course, as time went on, you know, the sales thing kind of evened out a little bit. And then nowadays we have the bundles, the Humble Bundles, the Fanaticals, like, where you're paying $10, $15, maybe $20, and you're getting 15 games. Or sometimes more, depending. Or you're getting a couple of games and a whole bunch of DLC for them. You just have to embrace the digital at that point, because it's like the deal that you're getting, the money you're saving, and the experiences you're getting access to and can have at your fingertips is monumental. But the trade-off is I'm constantly looking at what I have installed on my PC and being like, I should probably uninstall some of these games. I'm not going to play them.
Absolutely.
And some of the, you know, like a lot of the indie games, particularly the stuff that is like retro throwback in its visual presentation, you know, the pixel art and stuff, they're not huge games. You know, they don't have high poly counts and, you know, crazy 3D environments. So you can get, some of these games are like 300 megabytes. You can get dozens of games that size on a decent sized SD card or onto a hard drive. And so you can, and you know, you coming from the arcade cabinet community, the ROMs, like, as you know, with ROMs, you can have thousands of games on a hard drive or a flash memory device. So I have kind of, I understand the appeal of collecting physical. I've decided to put myself firmly in the middle, and I'm going to chase price more often than not. If I can save 20, 30% on something by going digital over physical, probably buying it digital. But I will make exceptions. Do you have time for me to rant?
Well, as long as Limited Run is still around, I'll still, even if it goes to all digital, I'm sure that I'll still be able to pick up physical copies of games that I really want just to add to my collection, because they'll make them.
Yeah.
Because the demand will be there, even more so than it is now.
I'm so glad you brought up Limited Run, because that was what my rant was going to be about. I'm going to make this super quick.
Go right ahead.
I had never bought anything from Limited Run before, but I knew who they were, and I really appreciated what they were trying to do. I strongly support this attempt to create physical media for games that would only get a digital release otherwise, for both an archival purpose, but also for the people who like to be a physical collector because they enjoy it. I think Limited Run's a great company. I had an awful experience because I backed the only game that I'm aware of that they've ever had almost a year delay on, and that was Celeste. And it wasn't even Limited Run's fault. I pre-ordered Celeste when it opened up. I believe it was the beginning of 2019. It was January of 2019. It did not deliver until October. And it did not deliver because the developer for Celeste, they announced that they were going to do the Farewell DLC, which was their final pass on the game, free DLC, you know, which was amazing, where they added a huge amount of more content and challenge modes and stuff. But it took them months to work on it. So Limited Run sets up their pre-order in January. They take all their orders. Their expected shipping window was like April. So that's usually all it takes, is like a 2-3 month turnaround for them. The developer's like, we're going to release this final DLC. You know, that it's going to be the end of our support for the product. And Limited Run says, well, part of what we're trying to do is be archival. We want to wait for that DLC to be done, and we'll include it on the cart. And so they waited, and they waited. And the developer was like, yeah, we're working on it. It's coming. And it took months. And by the time it came in October, my enthusiasm was gone. Because I had paid, I think it was like nearly $40 after shipping and everything, to get a physical copy of a game that is regularly about $10 in the eShop or on Steam, anyplace else. A game that I could have been playing for months if I had just got through a digital. But I really wanted to support a physical release of one of the most legendary platforming titles of all time. Like, a lot of people argue it's the greatest platformer of all time. And I wanted to own it physically. I wanted to support the idea of porting digital titles to physical media. And I just had the worst experience with it. Like, it's not that I'm impatient, but it's like, when you're watching all of these other games get produced and they're getting their 2-month turnaround, it's kind of demoralizing.
I can understand that, but don't let one bad experience ruin what could potentially end up being a very, very good experience with a very good company.
Yeah, no, and I strongly support Limited Run. I always have. I think they're... Now, there are some people in the community who like to take a dump on them, and they like to argue that they... Like, what they're doing is predatory. They're like, oh, they're just... They're playing on people's FOMO and everything. And I'm like, it's purely optional, dude. Like, these... You don't have to buy these games because you can buy them on the storefronts for pennies, comparatively.
Yeah, just tell Karen to shut up.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't fully understand those folks' mindset. You know, like, they're just like, oh, well, they're, you know, they're doing this, you know, they're artificial scarcity. I'm like, it's not artificial scarcity. They're a small company. They're literally, they take their pre-orders and then they up it to the next, like, X number of thousand units, and they order them from Nintendo. That's how it works. Or from Sony, if they're doing Vita or PlayStation 4. And, like, they order them, and then they get them. And they fulfill those orders. They keep a few for customer service issues, obviously. And they often lately they've had partnerships with Best Buy, where some amount of them get pre-bought by Best Buy. And they're on the marketplace. And... grumble about the fact that, like, some of the early releases aren't available anymore and they're double what the pre-order price was. Like, that's how the secondary market works. That's what happens when you get a limited run of a physical product that people really want to have. That's the nature of the beast, but it's an option. Nobody is preventing you from playing these games original digital means. They're out there. They're available.
It's amazing how still in 2020 there are people that don't know how business works.
Right? I'm going to self-promote here real quick. Shout out to a YouTube video I put out on Friday where I talked about Humble Bundle. I talked about some of my increasing concerns with Humble Bundle. I've been a longtime supporter of them. And one of the things that I fight with in the Humble Bundle community is every time the monthly choice comes out, you get all these troglodytes who crawl out of their caves and they're like, I'm pausing for the 8th month in a row. This is garbage. I own 5 of these games already. And I'm like, you what? Dude, if you own 5 of the games in the bundle already because you bought them through Steam sales or something else, this bundle cannot be garbage. You own half of the titles available already, which means it's a good bundle. It's just not good for you. It's not a value for you anymore. But that means the contents are choice. They're quality. Like, you...
All about me. It's all about me and what I want. Companies should do everything that I want.
Yep, that's entirely the mentality.
Lord.
And I've heard rumblings that that is an issue in a certain community that you're involved in, but we'll unpack that some other time.
Yeah, we're probably going to need to do a two-parter on that one.
Yeah. But yeah, no, so that's a thing for me, is like, it's all about the trade-off. You know, I am interested in a lot of other things. I'm interested in comic books. I'm interested in role-playing games. Because of services like Humble Bundle, I have lately been able to get digital comics and digital role-playing game books for my collection, which is way more convenient than having a bookshelf full of these giant, clunky $50 to $60 a piece role-playing game books, or these, long boxes full of comic books that are worth nothing. They're not even worth the paper they were printed on anymore. Comic books aren't worth anything anymore.
No, I'll eventually come around to that. Right now, I just want to see them.
Well, I know it's tough for you because, like, when you were growing up, you had to chisel your homework onto rocks, and it's hard for you to adapt to the modern age where we don't have to do that anymore.
No, because when you live in your mom's basement until you're 35 years old, they chisel them for you.
Excuse me, I'm 36 years old, and I haven't... I don't live with my parents.
Oh, good. You're the one.
Yeah, the one. But yeah, no, I get... It's that the digital versus physical thing is a tough conversation, and I think it really comes down to do what works for you. And I completely understand why people go both ways on it. And I look at people's physical collections and I'm in awe. And I have so much respect for them. And I just hope that they have homeowners insurance, because holy crap. know, that's
absolutely.
It's a wonderful thing. I think I want to thread the line a little bit. I want to own some physical copies of the games that I really love. Like, for example, if I ever bumped into a Final Fantasy VII for the PlayStation and its original, not the greatest hits, but the original jewel case, complete, I would probably drop a fair amount of cash on that. Like, I would be willing to pay good money for that to own it because I had it once and I don't have it anymore. And it's an awesome thing, and they're actually quite rare now because it was such a popular game and GameStop existed, and they
right.
They scoured the countryside of older games at one
point. So I would probably do the same for Chrono Trigger.
Right, exactly, and I would probably do it for Chrono Trigger as well. Yeah, so there's a handful of games that I would love to have a physical copy of. I won't play that PlayStation version again. I know I won't. I won't. Mm-hmm. I don't want to swap four discs and deal with a memory card. But owning the thing that was such a formative part of my history and like such a formative experience, having the original physical media is appealing. I just don't feel that way about everything. There's plenty of stuff that I'm content to download, play, uninstall, move on with my life, and I know it's there if I ever want it again.
Yeah, I got you.
Well, what do you think, Twig? Should we wrap it up?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we've covered all the bases that I wanted to cover with this topic.
Yeah. I didn't have as many as you did this time because I'm generally pretty flexible, but I have things that grind my gears that are usually more about like the community of people respond to things.
Well, we'll have to have a RAN episode where we talk about nothing but the gaming communities that we're involved in.
Oh, that'll be so fun.
Yes, I could even have guests in on that, and they could spar each other. It'd be hilarious.
Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah, the old MAA community, some of those characters. It'd be fun to watch duke it out. With that said, Twig, where can people find you on the internet?
All my socials are Get Off My Lawn Gaming.
All right. You can find me as Soapbox Klotz on Twitch and Twitter. I also have a YouTube channel with my lovely fiance Nicole, Soap and Squish. You can find that I just put out that Humble Bundle video on Friday. I had a little bit of fun with it. There's a couple of memes in there. It's about a 12-minute conversation about the changing nature of Humble Bundle. So if you're a PC gamer, if you're a Humble Bundle customer, hear me out. It's minimal rant. Minimal, I promise. And of course, my other show at the moment right now with Nicole is Crash Test Pilots, where we watch the first episode of television programs and give you the rundown. It's kind of like a book club for TV shows. We had a special guest this week. When this episode drops, it will have already been out for a week. So the Crash Test episode, our friend Emily Swan came on and we talked about Pushing Daisies, which was a lot of fun. So go check that out. Give that a listen. Let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you. And yeah, let us know what you think of this show. Hit us up on social media. You can find us and send us a message and be like, I really liked what you guys said about this. I hated what you said about this. We'd love to hear it either way. We love it when people tell us we're wrong so that we can tell them that they're wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I have a history of doing that with all kinds of topics.
Oh, do you?
Yes, I do.
All right, folks. Thank you so much for spending your time with us. We look forward to talking for you next time. Take care.